Welcome in, everybody. Hour two of the Bite Me Fishing Show coming your way. Hope everyone's having a great Sunday. Going to get you a great hunting season, never ends here in a bit. Of course, brought to us by Belleville Meat Market, which is kind of ironic given today's guest. But I wanted to start right here. Question here from a listener mentioning here. I know you answered him directly, Caleb, but it is from a listener, Clinton, about conservation. Does keeping only male trout and redfish hurt the fishery? He's been keeping the ones that are making that drumming sound.
Yeah, I was explaining to him in the comments that much like most of us learn after marriage, that males aren't nearly as necessary for reproduction as we think we are.
Yeah. Unless you go to summer camp.
Yeah. Well, there was no reproduction that I know of. But you got your spawners, and then you know X number of males to fertilize the little things. Mm-hmm. So, and I've taken the male, and the males seem to be a bit more numerous, I guess you'd say, or maybe they seem.
Oh, they are.
Oh, they are. It's an excess. They might just seem more numerous because those little suckers are out there eating like crazy, and the mama ain't.
Redfish all drum. All redfish vocalize.
Yeah, you shouldn't shoot any redfish ever, Clinton.
The thing about redfish, though, redfish that are in the slot up to 30 inches, they're. Sex is not determined yet. It is quite an interesting twist of nature that whenever redfish move offshore to become spawning age, then their sex is determined by nature as to if they need more females or more males.
Don't make California jokes. Don't make California jokes. Don't make California jokes.
Some people have to wait till high school.
I've become aware lately that this podcast is quite widespread. And I feel like might have listeners in California.
It is a weird twist of nature, but yes, those are they are asexual until they reach.
That is a fact. That is absolutely a fact.
tell us where you find them so we can conserve them even harder.
Only male speckled trout vocalize.
Hey, Gabriel and Ryan will attest that the redfish that I know where they're at are not in danger of being harvested. We found the most beautiful school of probably, I'd say 50 to 70 redfish in like two or three different little groups, but man, they were tailing the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. And it was way back somewhere where very few people go. I'm like, oh man, this is going to be on. And I put my power poles down probably about 70 yards from them. When my power poles touched the water, they're like, kiss my ass, we out. Just really? They went from tailing and being as happy as they could ever be until 2 3/4-inch PVC, fiberglass pieces of pole touched the water.
Yeah, they're gone.
Hey, look, Jay Schultz is telling where he can find them so he can conserve them even harder. I didn't get to say what I did this week.
Let's go. We got time.
Oh, I didn't do much.
Okay, thank you. That was very little long.
No.
That's the most non-selfish making it about yourself that I've ever heard.
And on that note,
it's been Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday has been some beautiful redfish, schools of reds. John, you just, man, I don't know how you miss it so much. When you were gone, the reds are schooling. I mean, I had a school yesterday that just changed the color of the water to orange. Today, here's another. Let me go. Here's a good story for you guys.
All right.
Even though this is kind of like Caleb's version of it, I saw big schools of redfish, two or three. The third one may not have been, but it was as I was going from spot to spot, I'm running, boom, and big herd of buffalo running across the flats. Pull up this morning. So what I was doing, I was shooting some video with the Wired to Fish. It's, from what I understand, it's a streaming fishing show network kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They're really big in the bass world, and I got connected with them. They were doing a paddling version show. So through some friends in Missouri, I got connected with them. He came down, wanted to do some kayaking, shoot a video. And unfortunately, my motor blew up in the middle.
And he got video of that.
My filter blew
up. Oil went everywhere.
But the curse of the first fish on the first cast.
Oh,
we
pull up
this morning. I'm running across the flats. Boom, right at daylight. Big herd of redfish. Boom, spooking. I swing around, pole down, throw two kayaks in the water. Paddling, got the camera over my shoulder. Zing, bam, blow up. Video, got the hook set, the whole deal. Boom, I'm like, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I should have thrown this damn thing in the bushes on the first cast. It would have done anything. Got that? Did not catch another damn fish.
Really?
One more rat red for the rest of the day.
Put them kayaks in the boat.
I went to four spots. As good as it has been all this week, I'll go out with the utmost confidence of like, we're fixing to get it on, son. I said, not only am I going, I said, we're going kayak style, stealth mode. And first cast, beautiful red, and for moved to four spots, fished pretty hardcore, and caught one rat red for the rest of the damn day.
Yeah. Oh, that sucks.
With the camera over my shoulder every damn minute of the day, sitting there staring at me.
Well, that's going to happen.
The moral of the story is, no matter how many redfish in front of you, if it's your first cast, throw the damn thing in the bushes, snap it off. Who cares?
My entire boat backlashes on the first cast when there's such cool in front of us. I have nothing to worry about.
Yeah. It's that weekday fishing like Ben's talking about. And I was talking about, I went the last two Mondays and it was fantastic, but not exactly the best conditions there, Caleb. What would you do?
If it's going out the whole day, I'm pretty happy with it. If it's coming in the whole day, Clint Bargy's pretty happy with it.
Yeah.
The
it's coming in and it's standing all day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that sucks. I don't like that at all.
Yeah.
Good.
And the water temperature is 89 degrees.
It's 89 now?
Can we talk about that desal plant some more?
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
So here's what's interesting about all that conversation. Rules are meant to be broken. It's just the way fishing works. And in spite of all of those things, which the curse is different, doesn't apply.
Cameras are a whole different thing.
Yeah. Oh yeah. A whole different category.
I'm going to have an upset stomach just thinking about it.
Very
depressing day, but in spite of all of those things, I mean, I've been fishing in crazy hot water and the bite has been going off at like 11:30 and noon has been some of the best fish.
Remember I mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, 11:30, it just turned back on.
11 to 2.
Yeah.
So slack ass tide, the middle of the day, but I mean, we still have been away from the full moon. I mean, that is, that was six, seven days before the full moon. So I can't blame the moon on that, but it less than stellar conditions and managing to do. One thing that's been interesting is those speckled trout that we were tearing up 2 weeks ago, they gone, man. I still pass through there at least once every day, just waiting for their triumphant return. And I don't know if it's me. I got the stink on my lure, but we've hit the drop-offs all around the outside of the islands and they just ain't there, man. I don't know. Or they're just not hitting what I'm throwing.
Yeah.
They're not liking me particularly.
How could they not like you?
But it's been an interesting week. The way red fishing has been quite good, and the speckled trout, which is normally very consistent this time of year, is kind of flippy floppy.
No, I mean, hell, my report just changed to go to Aransas Pass and fish between 11 and 2.
Yeah, exactly.
The fish I've been on have been super duper spooky. We're able to find a handful here and there, but they've been spooky. I went to some really reliable fish last week. They just weren't wanting to play ball in that half moon. So I'm thinking the full moon's going to get them stirred up and get them going again.
Okay, coming up, how about we talk a little high fence hunting? Some exotics that you may not target to eat, but are absolutely delicious, and the why of hunting next here on Sports Radio 610. Okay, welcome back. All right, you guys have heard me talk about it every Sunday. We put together our segment, Hunting Season Never Ends, and you know, full disclosure, I'm talking to the guy that I got that idea from. I got the idea from Marcus Poffenberger over at Belleville Meat Market. Because, you know, here on this outdoor show, it's, you know, we do a lot of talking with the captains about fishing. The captains are big-time hunters. Captain Dean has a thousand-acre ranch, and Captain Scott has guided on multiple ranches all over. And it's something that we want to definitely do as a show. But sitting in your office not long ago, Marcus, or sitting at Belleville Meat Market with you, you know, we talked about a lot of things that we're going to share here, in fact, because it's very fascinating stuff. But what you said, something about, you know, hunting season never ends. Belleville Meat Market, you know, we're open year round, and it you know, we'll get into all that. But I walked away, and I'm like, but it really doesn't, you know, it really doesn't. So let's start there. Lay it out for us, you know, for Texans.
Yeah. So you know, most states that don't have the privilege to have the game ranches that we do around here, the high fence capability. You know, you have hunting season in some states. It's like 2 weeks long for rifle season for deer. We're blessed to have a long rifle season for whitetail. We also have a long bow season and a long, you know, then there's the little youth season at the end with black powder. But it's not over there for us. Texas has so many game ranches that are just full of any kind of exotic game that you could find in Africa. You can find it in Texas. And the hunting season never closes on that. Mm-hmm. And we're a wild game processor at the meat market there. We process deer year round. We've done it forever. And it's just as we've watched as the game ranch industry has grown, we've watched our business grow throughout the summer. And you know, it's, there's just so many opportunities out there, and some processors will close down, you know, in February once the season closed, but we're open year round. So we're available to serve the state of Texas, all the hunters, all year round.
Well, let's hone in on the game ranches. You talked about the proliferation of so many. What are we talking here? And you don't have to be exact. I know you may not have the exact numbers, but what are we talking here from West Texas, where I've been a few times? You know, the last time I went was Audads and, you know, all kinds of. What are the numbers that you can kind of estimate in terms of these high fence game ranches in Texas?
I don't know the exact number. I know there's thousands of them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of them. And the amount of game that they've got on these ranches is insane. I mean, it's, you know, I believe my understanding is you have like the Scimitar Oryx on these ranches in Texas, and there's more Oryx in Texas than there is in anywhere else in the world, including their own home domain, where I think they're pretty much endangered or mm-hmm. extinct in some areas. Texas just provides the perfect environment for those animals. And there's so many of them, mm-hmm. and the cost to actually go hunt them is not astronomical. It's very affordable to do, especially in the summertime after rifle season closes. A lot of these game ranches offer better deals. Mm-hmm. Come shoot animals. You can shoot anything in your budget. You can shoot a broke horn oryx for a lot cheaper than you shoot a regular oryx, or you know, you can shoot axis or just pretty much anything. There's more of it here in Texas pretty much than anywhere else in the world.
Does it change and I'm talking about the actual hunting, you know, the higher temperatures, we know Texas, mm-hmm. you know, what changes in terms of, from a hunter's perspective, because we have so many listeners, as you know, outdoorsmen listen to the fishing show, but they want to talk about this. What changes in terms of just environment, approach, all that stuff?
As far as temperature goes, well, you get to hunt in shorts. Yeah. You know, the only thing you have to deal with is the mosquitoes, especially
maybe that.
I've gotten a little axis hunting the last few years, and the biggest predator out there is the mosquito, the Texas mosquito. you get past that,
but like their behavior and you know stalking and all that, is it kind of pretty much the same?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the same. I mean, you can hunt any way you want on Texas ranch. There's mm-hmm. not a whole lot of regulations on how you can hunt and what you can hunt with. Mm-hmm. You know, the guys who are hunting axis, you're typically hunting out of a blind or you're stalking them. Mm-hmm. You know, some guys can hunt them out of trucks if that's your thing, because there's really no regulations on what and how you can hunt these animals. kids. Mm-hmm. So it opens it up also for the whole family to enjoy. So you can, you know, the kids can go out and do it because it's easier. I mean, these are exotic animals that are probably, you know, in most of these game ranches are fed well. So they're somewhat easier to get than going out and, you know, trying to rattle up a whitetail and making a quick shot on a buck. These animals come to the water and they come to the feed. So they're easier to get. They're easy for a whole family to go out to a ranch and enjoy a good weekend out there, pretty much knowing you're going to come home with something. So for kids to go out and get experience shooting an African game animal in their backyard, basically right here in Texas, it's a pretty good experience.
Well, and the key thing here, and this is where it ties in with you guys at Belleville Meat Market, this is one of the things where I'm sure my jaw was open when you were telling me some of the animals that you have cleaned and butchered and eaten. And I think it would kind of make some people's head spin, even some veteran hunters that are our listeners. Like, give us some examples of, like, you, it's not just, hey, I got this, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's, this is going to be good to eat too. Like, what are some of the things that you're talking about here?
Yeah. So the majority of all these African game animals that we have over here, I'm probably going to get some diehard whitetail hunters think that I'm crazy, but they taste way better than any animal that's native to the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. The meat's naturally better. Like your oryx, your elands, your nilgais, which are super popular. People don't know nilgai tastes good. Axis is great. I'm not saying axis is better than whitetail. I think they're really similar. A lot of people believe that they're quite a few notches above. They're similar. But the thing about axis is they get fed really well, so they taste a lot better. You know.
Yeah.
But we've cut up everything. We've done, you know, we should have water buffalo, elands, zebras, you name it. Mm-hmm. You know, we pretty much cut it up, and most everything is good. I mean, and really edible. You can cook a good oryx roast in the house, and people aren't going to know it's not beef.
Yeah.
Same thing with nilgai. You cook a good roast or you cook a good steak, people are going to think, your family's going to think it's beef. And they're going to love it. And they're going to eat the whole thing. Whereas, you know, with maybe a little bit of a ruddy whitetail, you might have brought that home
sure.
to the freezer for 6 months and bring it out. And it's not great. And then, then your family eats something they don't like, and they don't necessarily encourage you to go back out and get another one.
Yeah.
With exotic animals, I mean, they're, especially ones in Texas, again, where they're fed well, they taste great. And, you know, the whole family will eat it.
And I'll recommend, again, you know, not to be a total shill here, but you guys do it right there. And you've tried and tested several animals that some people might sort of, you know, get back to the concept. What's one or two that you can tell us, you know, some people might say, oh, no, not that. But lo and behold, it's dang good. It's dang good.
I think one of the number one animals that I think is excellent, and it depends on where you get it from, is an all dad. And again,
I just talked about that. Yeah.
You're going to get listeners to think that this is crazy. All dads are trash, depending on where they come from. And it all depends on what they're eating and what they're fed. And if you get an all dad, a good wild all dad shot out in West Texas, eating sage bushes or brush or whatever they're eating out there, it's not going to taste good. And the best thing I can recommend them doing that with that is, let's turn it into some form of sausage that we can cover up that meat and hide all that gamey taste. But if you get an all dad that was raised on a game ranch and it's fed well, and it eats corn and protein and some of the native stuff, we've shot it. My wife and I have each shot a couple all dad on a game ranch out in Del Rio, but it was fed well. There was no bad flavor to it, no bad smell to it. It tasted amazing. There was nothing off-putting about it. I mean, there's some animals that you can get into, though, that I think
are a challenge. Like, what's been your challenge?
Where the biggest challenge?
My God, I'm gonna make this good.
Yeah, the biggest challenge, and I'll tell you, I failed at it. And I would love to hear somebody's recipe on this animal. If you call it an animal, it's a rhea. I don't know if you ever heard of a rhea bird. It's a miniature version of an ostrich.
Okay.
And my first shot one out in Del Rio, and I was dead set on trying to make this rhea taste great, because this ranch ranch we were at was overrun with these rhea. The guy had bought six of them, and within a few years he realized nothing eats rheas, nothing kills rheas. The parents are very protective of their young. Coyotes don't even target these animals. So yeah. They just populated his ranch. And so we and him kind of joked about it. I said, I'm going to give me a few of these Rias. I'm going to take these back and I'm going to make something good out of them. I know I can do it. I'm confident.
Well, let's see how that story turned out next on Sports Radio 610. We are back, joined by Marcus Poffenberger of Belleville Meat Market and a fantastic hunter. So, Marcus, you said you were going to do everything you can to make Rias good to eat.
I tried. I cannot. I've done everything you can think of. I turned it into jerky. I did everything that you could do to possibly cover up that flavor. But that is the one game animal that I can just honestly tell you, I can't do anything with it. And yeah. Anybody else can, I'd love to hear a great recipe.
Hey, you came to the right place. We got thousands of people listening, and we all get the messages and such.
Yeah, please comment on a good recipe on a Rhea. I would love it.
That's good. What about zebra?
Love you too, because they would probably be able to shoot.
Yeah. Yeah. What about zebra?
Zebra's good. Mm-hmm. Zebra meat has a funny look to it. The fat on a zebra is very yellow, super, mm-hmm. almost like a banana. Wow. And the meat itself, right next to the fat layer and the sinew layer, is super dark, almost purple. I mean, it's the funniest looking meat you've seen. The contrast between the yellow and that super dark meat, but it tastes great. Mm-hmm. Tends to be on the tough side. You know, you can tenderize the steaks and chicken fry them, but it makes great hamburger, makes great sausage, makes decent roast. But zebra's not bad. And there's meat on a zebra. Zebra's a heavier animal than
Oh yeah. And so our listeners who obviously a lot of them hunt on these game ranches, hunt year round. Mm-hmm. Do you ever get these calls where like, hey, I got this such and such. Can you do anything with it? I mean, you get those a lot.
Yeah, we get those a lot. I mean, it's random things. You know, people, one of the other animals that's hard to make taste good is javelinas. Guys have shot them, and, you know, you can smell a bad javelina as soon as you shoot it. It's either going to, you know, you can mm-hmm. smell it bad. But I've cut up some that were great and some that aren't. But, no, there's just so many different exotic animals that are available out there. I can't name them all. But
yeah.
You know, but there's everything you can imagine that's over there in Africa is here.
Yeah,
it's available to shoot.
What about regionally? Do these animals tend to thrive better in you know, West Texas, South Texas, East Texas, things like that?
Yeah. So your axes, I've noticed. I think we get bigger. The ranches that we work with, they grow a lot bigger axes. I feel like closer to East Texas. Like mm-hmm. we live in the meat market itself is in the Post Oak Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a few ranches that work through like Somerville, Texas, up through Iola. And that area tends to grow really big axes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe your West Texas axes. We have a few ranches in that area that we work with. They do have a few big ones, but consistency, the body size over here is bigger. And mm-hmm. I think it's a combination of having a wetter climate. Axes tend to graze more. They have more grass to eat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just less heat out here. It's a better climate for them. On top of the food that the ranches are feeding them, there's just so much other food
sure.
for them
to eat. Sure.
Their body sizes are bigger over here.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, regionally, the axes do a lot better over here. The other animals, I don't think the regions matter that much. I think those dry environments, they're used to the dry environments mm-hmm. Where they originally come from. So, you know, west of here, south of here. They tend to do fine. You're talking about your oryx species or your antelope, and your addicts mm-hmm. and all that. They tend to do fine everywhere.
So the message here is don't be afraid. Like again, from our listeners' perspective, don't be afraid to say, hey, you know, I want to get this, fill in the blank.
Yeah.
But it might be something that, you know, I really like, right?
Right. It most likely will be something you like. And my guys the market are really good about when you come to drop off or we go to pick up at your ranch, if you come to drop off too, we're really good about talking you through like, okay, yeah, we've seen this before. I remember mm-hmm. what this guy got on that animal. And I got the feedback from him saying, I like this, this, and this, make that for me again. So we can recommend to customers, you know, if you bring me something random, I've had guys bring me bobcats and cougars and, mm-hmm. you know, we've done everything we've done. They love them. I think the meat's great. Mm-hmm. But we've processed everything so we can bring me anything random. My guys can look at it and recommend what they've seen done before, what they've seen repeat customers come back and get year after year. And we can make it taste good.
I feel like I'm kind of burying the lead here, Marcus. You know, I didn't really give people a good background of where you like to hunt and your history. Cause you've hunted pretty much all over the world, right? Give us a little thumbnail sketch of just your background, because it's pretty impressive.
Well, say all over the world. Mostly of my hunting experience is North America. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten the privilege of one of my good fishing buddies, Hunter Neblett, invited me. He's a tarpon fishing friend of mine out of Port O'Connor. And I get a random email from him one day saying, "Hey, I want you to go to Alaska with me and hunt moose." This is about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why me? And he's like, "Well, you're a butcher. And like, we want to go shoot a moose, and you're a butcher." And he said, "You love the things that I love to do." And I, you know, so we put the trip together. That was 10 years ago. Now we've gone every other year for 10 years now.
It's great. Oh, wow.
And so we go every other year. We got a trip coming up this year. We've done good on all our trips except for one. We did strike out on one trip. We've shot multiple moose. He shot a moose a couple years ago, which we've been close to one. I think he was in the top 50 moose shot in Alaska. It was 68 inches and just scored amazingly well. Nice. So we've hunted moose. We've hunted caribou. We've done black bear. We've done a lot up there, and then we do it. And then I do a lot down here, just the different game ranches that privilege to go hunt with around here. We've shot, my wife and I've shot oryx, axis, all that, you know, red sheep. Red sheep is another animal that some people scoff at, but again, because they're fed well in you know, proper setting, the meat's fine. It's not for muttony. It's not bad. But
where do you hunt around here? Where's your go-to?
So around here, we have a place just east of Lockhart. So it's not far from here. It's an hour and a half for me to drive out, and we get out there on the weekends. This is where we whitetail hunt. I do get to get away on the weekends. I get to run out there after work and after the kids get out of school on Friday, and we get to go hunt the weekends, and we're back by Sunday afternoon. It's not a super long drive, and we've shot some really good animals out there. My wife shot a really nice one. I guess about 6 years ago, a couple years after we started hunting there, and she got on the cover of Texas Trophy Hunters with it.
Oh, wow.
Really nice whitetail. But we get to get out there, and we do, it's more than just hunting for us. We go out and we cook big meals. We have nice places to stay out there. So it's focused on our family. They all come out. We cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner and out there. And it's more about just getting together and getting away for the weekend. And then getting back to the grind during deer season on Monday with a good clear head and a good memory.
Hey, man, it matters.
It does.
It matters. I just told someone today, you know, like, you know, we all, and this isn't poor me, and I'm sure you're not saying poor you, but we all have, you know, long days, hard work, you know, and come Friday afternoon, I mean, I turn it off. I mean, it's off until Sunday evening. And so that's one of the beauties of what you have here. Back to as you were talking about some of the animals that you've gotten, I'm wondering, is there a white whale out there for you? In other words, is there something out there where you're like, God dang it, I got to get one of those?
There's two that I haven't shot that I've always wanted to. And for years it was a black buck. I don't know why. It was my uncle was a biologist years ago, and he would bring my dad bring home black buck antelopes horns. Mm-hmm. And that was he was doing his thesis on those. So he would bring him species, like specimens that he didn't want. And so growing up, always saw these little black buck spirals all through my house, and always shoot one of those. And then after I shot that, a decent one of those, I think the two animals I haven't shot that I want to shoot is I want to shoot a nice addix, and I want to shoot a nice spotted fallow. I don't know. The chocolates and the white fallows, I don't know why they don't do it for me, but the pretty spotted fallow with good deep spots is something I really want to get. I haven't gotten it. It's on the list.
That's so cool. Yeah. I do want to get to your knife skills, because again, you know, I hunt, but not like Captain Dean or Captain Scott or you know, Marcus Canales, who joined us on the show. And I just like to go, you know, for the camaraderie and the pictures and the smells and the sights and sounds, and I'll shoot all the hogs you want me to, you know, but my amateur hunting mind always kind of goes to you know, like the guys that can clean a whitetail perfection, and you're at the top of the game. Just appease me. How fast can you clean a whitetail?
Let's find out next. All right, we're back. One more with Marcus Poffenberger from Belleville Meat Market here. So how fast can you clean a whitetail, Marcus?
As far as just field dress them?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd field dress them in a few minutes.
And what about butchering?
Butchering, I could debone a whitetail. I'm not as good as I used to be. In the recent years, I've been able to get off the table as much. My butchers are probably gonna laugh at this when they see it, because they could do it faster than me now. But when I was good, I could completely take the bones out of a whitetail in about 15 minutes.
Good gravy.
Yeah, that's amazing. We did the fastest thing. When I got invited to go to Alaska, and I'm bragging on myself a little bit here, but I'm bragging on my buddy because he was a lot of help. We did the first moose we shot in Alaska. We had it in the bag, in the game bags to transport within an hour and 45 minutes.
A moose
in an hour and 45 minutes.
Wow.
It wasn't boneless, but it was quartered up, ribs cut off. The only thing left on the ground was a backbone, and it was in bags ready to go, hour and 45 minutes.
And that's why it's Belleville Meat Market.
That's all I've ever done. So I grew up cutting meat. My dad made me require all of us siblings to have a full-time job, at least on weekend. We called it full-time. We had to have a weekend at 13. And we had the choice. We could work at the meat market or we could go do something else. I chose to work at the meat market. So I started cutting meat when I was 13.
And you love it.
I love it. That's all I ever did. I don't cut as much as I used to, but when I do kill something or get to the ranch and get a chance to have, get on the table out there, I love every minute of it. It's fun.
What's the most difficult one to do on a regular basis?
I think wild hogs are hard to debone. Mm-hmm. They're bone structure. I mean, it's the same bone. Yeah, they all have the same bones as all the other animals. It's just they're harder bones. They're harder to the muscles are just, it's just different. It's the hard, the slowest thing for me to debone is, I would say, is a wild hog.
Really? That's but certainly you mentioned javelinas, but hogs, again, very good. Done the right way. They're very good. Hey, I wanted to ask you about this before we move on. Just a couple more things. I won't keep you all day, but I think it's spring turkey season is what they call it. You guys can do all of that and just explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so we do a few different things not a whole lot of things, turkeys. We can smoke the turkey breasts. If customers bring us turkey breasts, we can smoke those and to where they're fully cooked, where you could just slice them, or we could just smoke them lightly. It's something you're going to finish off yourself. Mm-hmm. A lot of guys will bring them in, and we'll make jerky out of the turkey breast for them. Again, a wild turkey doesn't have a whole lot of meat on it compared to a domestic turkey. But sure, there's enough to make a few pounds of turkey jerky off of it. Mm-hmm. The thighs and the legs, I usually like to recommend just getting those cut up, vacuum packed whole. I like to take those turkey legs and boil them up and cook them up with some beef stock or some chicken stock, and basically to where the meat starts to get tender, shred that meat off the bone and make a good soup out of it. Mm-hmm. No matter how old the wild turkey is, even if it's a super tough turkey, if you boil it long enough, you can shred that meat off there, get rid of all those tendons, add some celery, add some vegetables to that pot, and you've got some soup that the whole family will eat. And the big thing is too, we always try to want to make something that a hunter's going to take home to his family. They're going to like it, like the turkey jerky. Everybody's going to like that. And they're going to tell you, hey, if you want to go hopefully they tell you, if you want to go turkey hunting again, go again. Because you bring that home when it's over. You make the wife and kids happy.
Mm-hmm. I bet your kids, you have more than one, right?
I'm going to have a little daughter. She walked through earlier. She's 15, and I have a son who's 6.
When they have friends come over, they must be blown away. How many times have they gone, man, this is really good? And you're like, well, that's such and
such. My daughter is she will eat anything. She grew up with me outside. We do a lot of trapping, too. We do a lot of trapping around the area. We trap beavers and otters and everything else that's out there. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing I haven't brought home that she hasn't eaten and said it was good. And I think she's lying to me on some of them. But she enjoys the heck out of seeing. I try to tell them the importance of, if we're going to go out there and kill something, we're going to eat it. Yeah. If we can, we're not killing it for no reason. Right. Mm-hmm. So we always experiment with everything. She shot a few deer in her lifetime. We'll take the hearts and we'll take them and slice them up and we'll chicken fry those and eat those. But anything we bring home, she'll eat it. I try to get them to understand the importance of not killing things just to kill things.
Okay, give us your opinion and thoughts on that, because that's an issue for some people. Give us what people should know about that.
Well, it's hard balance too, because again, we trap, and so we trap a lot. Like at the ranch, we trap to to just keep the predator count down, you know. Mm-hmm. Just, I mean, we trap coons, and I don't really bring the coons home to eat. Yeah. But I still try to instill like the there's reasons why. Because so that the whitetail that would do eat can thrive. Because mm-hmm. a big herd of coons can run off some whitetail from a protein feeder. If you're trying to feed out whitetail or any other exotic, and every night this herd of coons come up and runs them off, well, they're not eating as much as they can, so their potential horn growth is not going to be as much as it is. So we trap those for a reason. Mm-hmm. We kill the possums because they eat the turkey eggs. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not. But if there's something that we kill that it's decent to eat, and there's reason behind it, we'll bring it home and cook it up, you know, and eat it and discuss the value of the life that, you know, that God made that animal for a reason. And we're not just going to waste it. We're going to eat it, and we're going to try to find a way to make it taste good while doing it.
Man, that is awesome. Before we get out of here, you've given us such good stuff. But one thing I haven't asked about is actual Belleville Meat Market, because what you guys do, and one of the things that really is important to me is not just the year round. If anybody has anything, they can bring it by. We talked about that, but the way that you process, the way that you make sure they're getting their animal. And I think the most important thing, the way that you, I don't know if you call it vacuum packing or whatever, but the way you prepare the packaging for your customers, that meat is going to be good for more than a year, if not longer than that, correct? Right. And why is that?
Well, we use the most expensive packaging we can get as far as the vacuum pack film goes. And again, we go back to that same topic we just talked about. There's a lot of importance put on the life of that animal. So if you take that animal and you shoot it, you harvest it, you take it home and you throw it in your fridge, and then 6 months later you have to throw it away. That's a waste. So yeah. We do everything we can to make that animal go longer and give it meaning, and so, you know, to feed your family for longer. So we spend a lot of money on higher end packaging products. It's very important to us that, you know, when you were processing your animals, that we keep them separate. Not everybody cleans their animal the same way as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And everybody puts as much pride into the cleanliness of their animals. So we've always done it. My dad started it in 81, just processing every animal separate than everyone else. We're not mixing them together. We don't stop short with just keeping the meat and the hamburger and separate. We keep every batch of sausage separate. Mm-hmm. Even our boudin, we make boudin and tamales and hot dogs, which even a lot of processors will mix that together and separate out, because it's a hard thing to do to keep separate.
Sure, sure.
But we come up with methods to cook those. We cook each individual batch of tamale meat separate from the next customer's individual batch of tamale meat. Mm-hmm. Same thing with boudin, same thing with hot dogs. Just because it's important to us that you get your meat back that you brought up and nobody else's. And so, yeah, we go through a lot of steps. It's not easy. It's not cheap. But I think it's important that people get the animal that they shot, and that animal needs to last a long time in your freezer when you get
and
it.
Here I thought, you know, I just go to Belleville Meat Market, pick up some summer sausage and some some of the great the sandwiches you have and all that, and maybe some OG sauce too.
We were serving at the ranch here about 2 months ago. We were serving the OG on my steaks.
How about that? Well, listen, man. It really does, and now I'm bragging, but no, it really does. That's why I made it. I mean, because I made it because I a particular flavor I was looking for, and I know you go through this. Like, there's a particular flavor I'm looking for, and it's not quite there. So I just made it, you know, about 6 years ago or so. All right. So last thing, and I'll let you go. You have to shoot, harvest, butcher one animal tomorrow, and put on a meal for your best friends and your family. What animal is that?
It would be a young white-tailed doe, and I would take the shoulder, and I would take that shoulder, and I would leave the shank on. I would tie it up as tight as I can get it, shoulder blade, down to the arm, down into the shank. I would put that in the oven with a whole bunch of onions. I'd throw some white potatoes in that pot with it, throw some olive oil, some water, cover it with copious amounts of black pepper, some salt, and I would add some garlic, and I'd roast that in the oven for about 5 hours at 350. And then I'd pull that out and I would just shred it off the bone. Just basically not even shred off the bone. You just pull the bones out of it at that point.
Yeah.
Chop it up with a knife and serve it. It's the world's best pot roast.
That is so good.
You got the potatoes right there, who's been soaking up all that flavor while they're cooking. And it's just a full meal right there all in one pot.
Dean gave me a shoulder this past weekend. I'm gonna make some carne guisada with it.
Oh yeah, that works too. We'll do the same thing, and we'll take it instead of once we shred it, we'll just season it a little bit lighter. But then while we're shredding, we'll just throw taco mix into it.
Yeah,
we'll take that and make tacos. I mean, my kids, they
same concept. Same concept. Those shoulders, and a lot of people don't like. They're like, "Eh, I don't know, man. That's some good stuff right there."
when you roast it that way, all that sinew and all that silver skin and all that collagen in the bones, everything renders down into this liquid in the body. Yeah. You get all the vitamins, all the good flavor and all the good everything good out of it, and all in one pot. It's easy to do.
Well, man, really appreciate it, and we appreciate you. Thanks for joining us here and listening on the Bite Me Fishing Show. Let's do it again on Thursday. Until then, have a great rest of your Sunday, a great week. Catch them up, and we'll talk to you next time.